Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello, I'm Patricia Haas-Cleveland, president of OnFit US, and today we are joined by Stephen Stoneberg.
Stephen is COO and CFO of Bittrex Global, a cryptocurrency trading platform and digital wallet infrastructure. Stephen, it's great to speak with you today. News about crypto and digital space has been dominating the headlines in recent weeks, so your perspective, sitting in the middle of this crypto ecosystem, is particularly welcome to explain some of this.
Okay, well, thanks, Patricia, for having me here today, and it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Just to kick off the discussion, let me say the obvious, that it seems we're certainly witnessing the growing intersection, some might even say collision, of the world of traditional finance and that of innovative technology and digital finance. So given everything that's going on, let's call it a digital revolution in money, what do you see as the most significant innovations? And that would include the technology behind these innovations.
So I think at a high level, in the 90s, we had the internet boom, and then you had, facilitated by that technology, what I would call the Amazon moment for retail, you know, where regular bricks and mortar retail just couldn't compete anymore. And I think that that's kind of what we're about to happen with money, or is happening right now. And I loosely, and when you talk about money, I just loosely use that as like financial services. So I think, you know, with crypto and blockchain being the technology behind it, and it's been going on for a while now, but I think you're now seeing it. It's eroding into the traditional world, and it's only, it has collided, and it's just, the collision is just going to become more and more forceful. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out on the other end of it when it's done. But I think that, you know, the biggest things that you're seeing, you know, blockchain is a much more efficient way of settling transactions, and blockchain transactions or crypto, I use those interchangeably. I mean, it trades 24/7. It's much more efficient. When you look at the financial services industry, it's using very old technology that's been around for years. I mean, it still takes 3 days to send a U.S. dollar wire from a bank in Europe to the U.S. I mean, that's insane. I mean, you know, all this plumbing was designed 40, 50 years ago, and they haven't really updated it that much. They might have nicer user interfaces on the front end, but nothing's really changed. They've had no incentive to change it. And why would they? They're making a lot of fees and money until something completely disrupts it like this. So I think that's kind of what I see happening at a macro level with crypto.
So I guess it's not just crypto, but it's really the technology behind it that you think is kind of, if you will, the Amazon of our time, or the Amazon of now, sort of this blockchain technology, which enables you to do crypto and many, many more things.
Exactly. So, I mean, blockchain is just a way of settling transactions. And for financial services, they have multiple parallel systems, that all of which are held together by tape and glue. They're so old. But, you know, equities, you know, European equities have one settlement system. U.S. equities have a different settlement system. Cash has different settlement systems depending on which bank you're using. You know, in the U.S., it's something called ACH for wires. In Europe, they have SEPA. So you have this completely fragmented set of systems, and each type of asset has a different system. So if it's currency, it's one system. If it's stocks, it's one system. If it's bonds, it's another system. So none of that makes a lot of sense. So with blockchain, loosely, you're using smart contracts, and a smart contract is a smart contract. So it doesn't matter what you put on the blockchain, because you can have currency represented, as we're seeing with, you know, Tether or, you know, central bank digital currencies that are coming. So anything can go on the blockchain. So the nice thing about the blockchain is just the blockchain, and it's one sort of like massive global settlement system for everything, if you want to sort of think of it in a loose way, which operates 24/7 and you can access on your mobile phone. That's very different than the sort of very old legacy systems that the banks are using that started so many years ago that they can never wean themselves off of them. They've just built on top of bad technology. Here's like they took a nuclear bombing and just blowing the whole thing up and starting from scratch.
Right. So I think a lot of folks, when they hear the word blockchain, they think, oh, that's technology. I don't really understand that. There's sort of a myth around what it's all about, almost, you know, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, what's really behind that. But let's move away from blockchain for just a second and look at some of the other recent trends that are dominating the headlines. I mean, we hear about decentralized finance. We hear indeed about blockchain. We hear about Bitcoin at record levels. We hear about other cryptocurrencies, stable coins, a move towards institutional adoption and servicing of cryptocurrencies. You've seen a lot of institutional and corporate players come into the arena, whether it's Tesla, PayPal, BlackRock, MassMutual, Bank New York Mellon, MasterCard, even Christie's art auction. And this is before we even get to more recent headlines around tokenization of stocks and NFTs. So let me just say, even though blockchain as a concept might be difficult for the average person to understand, these are things everybody's hearing about. So are these isolated trends, these developments I've just mentioned, or are they actually developments and trends moving in the same current that is actually going to redefine the future of money? And undoubtedly, a common denominator with a lot of this is indeed blockchain. But maybe you could talk about some of these trends and kind of what's driving them and what impact some of these trends will have on the ecosystem as it evolves.
Let me just talk about blockchain for a second. So I think, you know, and Patricia, without dating ourselves, you're old enough like me to remember when, you know, computers, personal computers came out and everyone was like terrified of them. At the end of the day, you know, to use your Apple MacBook, you don't need to be a computer programmer or you don't need to understand why it works. It just does. And I think blockchain's the same way. Like, you don't have to understand all these codes. At the end of the day, it's just an interesting technology that facilitates transactions in all sorts of different asset classes. So that's like, let's move away from like being scared of it. So, but in terms of your question, you know, all these trends, I think, so blockchain is the, again, going to cause the Amazon moment for financial services. It's not new. It's been around at least for the last, you know, 10 years. It's just slowly been eroding away. I think what's accelerating it now, I think it's a whole host of factors. You've got the fact that we've all been trapped at home. and by definition, you know, crypto and blockchain is very decentralized. So it's sort of, we were already living the COVID lifestyle before COVID without knowing it. And I think, you know, now everyone else on planet Earth was too. And these products are accessible on your computer 24/7. So you have a lot of people trapped in their house with time. Then on top of that, with the financial stress that the whole COVID situation has caused, that you're seeing massive central bank printing, people afraid of inflation, and it's driven, again, the interest in this new asset class, plus all of the volatility in the asset class itself then drives in the institutions, and then the institutions driving into it then causes the price to go up, and then you have retail. So it's this like interesting J curve that I think that we're on. So I'm not, you know, it totally makes sense. This was always going to happen. I think we've hit this new inflection point though. I think because of the disruptions with COVID, it's just accelerated something that was already happening, frankly.
Yes, and I think, not to jump ahead, but I totally agree with you. And I think the general view out there is that COVID not only accelerated sort of, you know, the consideration of digital currencies, because not just as a hedge, as you mentioned, because there's concern about inflation with all these fiscal payments, but it also sort of highlighted the inefficiencies in the payment system. It was very hard to get some of these COVID relief payments out to folks. But let's come back to that and just stay on some of these recent trends that are out there. One that we haven't really zeroed in on, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is in fact the tokenization of stocks. That's sort of been in the headlines more recently. We certainly saw the whole Robinhood and GameStop saga. On the one hand, it's considered an interesting way to improve access of investment opportunities for retail investors, so-called sort of democratization of finance. On the other hand, in the case of Robinhood, it also showed that some of the smaller retail investors can get burned. So tell us a little bit about tokenization of stocks. How is a Tesla token different than having and owning Tesla stock? I think it'd be great to hear from your perspective, sort of what are the benefits of tokenization?
So I think, so any asset can be tokenized. So again, Bitcoin is just a digital asset, you know, right? But you can have dollars are being digitized right now through Tether. So there's lots of different ways of digitizing real world assets right now that exists. I think before we go into sort of tokenized stocks, I want to just distinguish that. So there's utility tokens in crypto, and then there's something called a securities token. So a securities token, just because it's a token, is still considered a security, like in terms of the real world, in terms of how you sell this. And that's why you don't see a lot of securities tokens right now, because that's just not what most crypto firms are set up to do, right? You still are trading something that is deemed a security out in the outside world. So Bitcoin and all most of the assets that you see on crypto exchanges right now are what's called a utility token. It's not equity. It's not an ownership stake in a company, and it's not regulated the same way securities are. It's much less regulated, or if at all. So then tokenized stocks. So our exchange, which we run a completely regulated utility token exchange, and now we've set up another exchange where we can trade these. It's actually in Bermuda, where we are allowed to trade these types of tokens. And effectively, all you're doing is creating it's a derivative. So it's no different than like these derivative certificates that trade by the banks right now. If you want to get exposure to like a basket of stocks, like Deutsche Bank issues a certificate and it's linked to anything you want it to be, well, you can do the same thing with the token. So in our case, we have another exchange, which is called FTX. It's a friendly competitor, and they have issued tokens linked to Tesla, Amazon, Apple, and it's secured on a derivative. So it's really no different than the sort of Deutsche Bank like certificate example. And you can reference anything you like. So the equities are held somewhere. In this case, I won't go into it. It's by a broker and they're hedging it. But just like when you buy those certificates issued by a bank, you don't really know how the bank's hedging their oil risk or whatever the certificate is linked to. Here it's just linked to an equity. So you're getting the risk of Tesla and the financial value of Tesla without actually having to own Tesla. So it's in the form of a token. And unlike Tesla stock, which only trades when the exchange is open and then you have to buy a full notional share, here you're buying a note or a token. It's in the form of a note, effectively, but it's linked to that risk. You can buy it in smaller size that meets your sort of investment parameters. Like, you know, a share of Tesla is $800 roughly now. Maybe you only want to invest $2 or $10. Well, you can do that. You can buy just an amount of tokens to represent that risk. And then these tokens trade 24/7. Crypto doesn't close. The exchange doesn't close. So you don't have this situation where you can only buy it during certain hours. And again, to buy U.S. equities, let's say that you're unbanked sort of retail in a developing country in Africa. Well, you're not going to have access to U.S. equities. You're not a client of one of these U.S. brokerages that sell those stocks. Here, you still have to go through KYC and AML to become a client of our exchange. But you know, we would allow an international client. So you're all of a sudden, and then you could also buy that token using a Bitcoin or a fractional piece of a Bitcoin. You don't have to even use cash. So this is just really the tip of the iceberg. You're really here seeing the flexibility and the disruptiveness of this technology. Again, none of it's rocket science. It's just you have a really inefficient by design, you know, old world financial services industry that's just ripe for this type of innovation.
So just to recap that, so basically the benefits of this is that you can, it's easier to access, you have lower minimal amounts, in other words, then you can have fractional ownership, it's backed by the underlying and related, its value is related to the underlying security, but it's not a security, and it trades 24/7, so you can get it anywhere. So, you know,
well,
that
it is a security in terms of it's a derivative, so the end product is considered a security, but you're not buying Tesla stock. You have no right to Tesla stock by buying this derivative security.
Exactly. So those are the benefits. Do you see any obstacles to this market developing further, or how do you see it going down the road?
No, not at all. I think, you know, the obstacles are that it is, you know, securities is a very regulated industry. So I don't think all the players in crypto, a lot of them don't really do regulation, shall we say. We do. So I think that's going to be a natural barrier to entry in a good way for some of those players. But, you know, it's still very new, this sort of securities tokens, and there's not a ton of liquidity. So it's like any new market. It's going to take some time, but I think you're going to see very fast growth. And some of the other things that you mentioned, I mean, that's just one example of a security token that we just talked about, a tokenized stock. But these art tokens are non-fungible tokens that represent a specific piece of art. I mean, that market's booming. So you're going to see it's effectively securitization is all this is. Like the securitization boom of the 80s is now going to be replicated on a global scale for any type of asset. But you're putting them in a much more efficient type of vehicle, which is a token. And tokens can be sold to retail globally in overnight. So that's what's very different about, I think, again, the the potential for this is huge.
Let's just go back to the Robin Hood and GameStop episode for a second, because I think that drew a lot of attention, certainly on Capitol Hill. They dedicated at least a half a day to grilling some of the key players in there. And one of their big concerns was, you know, the impact on the sort of the new guy to investing, the retail guy. But basically, there's going to have to be a step back and kind of looking at this intersection between, you know, a lot of activity on social media and the ability of that to galvanize investors, many that are new to the market. How do you think this is going to be dealt with? I know you don't know all this. This is obviously something, no doubt, the new SEC chair will be focusing on. But by and large, it suggests there needs to be more education about these opportunities and these instruments. Do you see this coming down the road? Is it just a slow, steady, get more information out there?
In the specific case of Robinhood, I think intricate. I mean, it's really not about GameStop. It's about the use of Robinhood in these, I mean, and other brokers. But I think people didn't really understand what Robinhood was. They thought it was this, like, as the name would imply, take from the rich and give to the poor. But in reality, Robinhood is just a retail technology front end, and it's really Citadel Securities you're trading with. And I think for crypto, which Robinhood's offering, they were doing it, I think, they changed, I'm not sure who their provider is, but it's just a front end. It's a marketing front end that looks like it's young and fun and helping. It's a marketing company with some technology. And behind it was Citadel Securities, which also runs a hedge fund that was shorting these stocks. And I think that, of course, it's highly politicized. And, you know, again, I don't want to run the risk of saying something that I shouldn't say on a podcast, but I think that that was really the revelation there. There was a big conflict of interest and problems that I think now retail understands what Robinhood is. It's not, it's effectively, it's not this decentralized sort of like fun young company. It's something that's, it's a highly institutionalized business that had its own self-interest at heart. So that's how I see that situation. So if you look at crypto, and, you know, it's a very libertarian market. It's global. It's people who want to have access to information. All the same sort of stuff operates in crypto. There's lots of Telegram chat groups and people talk about what types of assets they want to buy. I mean, I think the industry itself is so new and fragmented, and it does need, you know, there is some regulation. We're a self, by choice, we choose to self-regulate and adopt regulations. Other players don't. So I think there's a lot for the regulators to figure out and, you know, for Mr. Gensler to sort of take on. But I think in the case of, you know, GameStop there, I think it was just, it's a highly complicated and nuanced setup. I don't think there's anything wrong with these investors talking in chat groups. In fact, that's what they're supposed to do. I think what let them down was that there was a huge conflict of interest in the vendor that they were using for their trades. And
yeah,
that didn't become apparent until afterwards.
Yeah, I didn't want to zero in on that as a typical case, but I think it speaks to the fact it's good for folks to understand what's going on and to be more transparent about how these things work, because there is a huge opportunity out there, as you said, with crypto, using blockchain, that can benefit a lot of investors. It's just that really stole the headlines for a while.
Just to build on that, but during that whole GameStop, that week when everything froze, we announced and we issued, you know, on the exchange, you could buy all the stocks that Robinhood delisted or stopped trading in. We created, or FTX created, synthetic tokens, which we then immediately listed on our exchange and traded 24/7. So even if you couldn't get exposure by buying the outright stocks on Robinhood, you could come to our crypto exchange if you're a non-US passport holder, non-US resident, you could onboard. You could get exposure to the risk in a different format. And that's not something that existed before. And that shows you the power of this disruption that's going to start happening.
Right. And it also shows you that in a way, the players in this ecosystem, there's an element of institutionalization that's going on, so that there are roles for everybody and that, in fact, the marketplace can work. I think that that case highlighted some inefficiencies in it. I want to turn switch channels altogether and just ask you on a personal question. You actually come from a traditional finance background. So what prompted your switch into crypto, and how do you think, this is the big elephant in the room in my view, how do you think the development of crypto and the future of money is actually going to affect traditional finance?
you know, I was already long in the tooth in finance. I had 25 years doing it in traditional finance. And I think within traditional finance, I was always drawn to, at the time, what were considered like the high growth areas. Like I got into credit derivatives before there were actual credit, they were even called that. So I was definitely ahead of the curve there. I thought that, you know, already, this is like 2006 when I moved to the buy side, I thought traditional finance was already becoming a bit less exciting and more commoditized. And I moved to the buy side or to the hedge fund world and I went to go work for Brevan Howard, which was, you know, very exciting. And then, but, you know, already even with hedge funds, I think now that's kind of commoditized as well. And so when I saw crypto and this whole industry, I was like, wow, this is like 1980 again in financial services. You know, we're about to have this huge new innovation and boom, and I want to be part of that. And that's sort of how I've always made, you know, sometimes very rash career decisions, but they tend to be, you know, they play out. I mean, it's looking a lot better, my decision now at Bitcoin to 50,000 than it did sort of, you know, at Bitcoin X a year and a half ago. So, and I'm not long Bitcoin. It's just that obviously that when the industry is doing well and there's higher volumes, it's great. So I think that's kind of at a high level how I've approached it. And, but I would say what I view crypto is just, or these crypto exchanges, this is financial services. I think that a lot of people in the industry see it, oh, it's technology, this is new, we're not subject to these regulations. And, you know, we've already seen some enforcement actions. And I think under Gensler, that should probably ramp up. That no, actually, just because you think you're not in financial services, just because they settle on the blockchain, like Tether or Bitcoin is a financial product and you're selling it into Americans or into other countries, you will be subject to regulations. And I think that's where this has been a bit unclear and gray. So I think it's hugely exciting. I would say with experience in the traditional financial services world, at least one is sort of used to the type of regulatory environment and you get it and you don't mess around with that stuff. Like it's not funny. Like, you know, there's, it's black and white. There's no gray. But I think that's going to be the challenge for this industry. And a lot of the people that are in the crypto only side really don't come from that background. And I don't think, you know, when Amazon and all these tech companies were setting up in the 90s, they might have infringed on sales tax or some things. But, you know, it's a little bit different when you're dealing with money laundering and all this other stuff. I mean, those are like serious crimes. So I think that the infractions that a lot of these companies may unknowingly be stumbling into are a lot more serious. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this starts to mature. It's not going to be linear. It's not going to be pretty. And there's going to be some winners and losers.
Right. And I think that there's a certain amount of optimism that a number of the nominees that President Biden has put forward in the regulatory roles do, in fact, have crypto background and knowledge. So hopefully there will be some, you know, highly informed decisions made to that both provides and serves a regulatory purpose to ensure proper oversight and financial stability and all that, but also allows for innovation because finding that balance can often be very challenging. You mentioned winners and losers. Do you want to go down that road a little bit further? Do you think that the traditional large banks that have been up and running for a long time, working in a certain way, will adjust and adapt and be part of the winners in the new system? Or how do you see some of the more traditional firms participating?
I think, well, crypto moves so fast. And I think, you know, as we see, I saw that Goldman just announced they're setting up a crypto desk again. I think they had one the last cycle. They set it up and shut it. And now Coinbase is IPOing and their market cap is bigger than Goldman Sachs. So, you know, you would argue, maybe they should have kept that crypto desk for 2 or 3 years. But I think that, look, I don't think these institutions are going to disappear, but I think that as we saw, you know, even the most esteemed retail names that nobody ever thought of would ever disappear when Amazon was just selling books over, you know, sort of dial-up internet. I think this is, you know, it's unclear how this will play out. I think that the traditional players, you know, most of them have been pretty slow and they've already missed out on a lot of this. So, you know, it's still early days, but I think that you now have a globalized business now as opposed to regional, which is the way financial services operate. And it's completely different technology. And as we've seen, the banks are not sort of technology is not their forte. In fact, if anything, like hiding the bad technology and just kind of putting band-aids on it is sort of what they do. So I don't know. Obviously, I've taken a bet. I've left the traditional banks and moved to sort of the more tech and startup-y side of it. So maybe I'm speaking from a biased position. I just think that, you know, the industry is going to grow. It's unclear it will boom, and it's unclear if the existing players will be the dominant players. I think they'll still exist, but we'll see a lot of innovation and change.
So let's go back a second. Thank you very much for that view, because sitting where you do, as I said, having been in both worlds, it's kind of a unique perspective. But let's move to the regulatory side, because you did say that no matter what, these are financial services that in fact are being offered and are out there, and it will require some regulation. And yet so much of the regulation that exists today is really sort of 20th century regulation, not 21st century regulation, and how you adapt that for the digital asset innovation is very challenging. We know the OCC has taken some steps in the last sort of 6 to 8 months to allow national banks to custody crypto assets, to offer services to stablecoin users, and to even, you know, let national banks and Federal Savings Association use blockchain. Meanwhile, right before Christmas, we had Treasury come out with some proposals, which are, you know, viewed pretty negatively by a lot in the crypto community because they required pretty stringent reporting requirements. And you've got the SEC, which is kind of in the middle of everything. As you said, they have a lot of questions in front of them. So how do you see this playing out? If somebody were to give you, and then that doesn't mention the CFTC, which already defined Bitcoin as a commodity years ago. So how do you see, or let me put it this way, if somebody gave you a blank piece of paper and said, here, make some suggestions on how do we approve this? Do you kind of tinker with the existing regulatory structure, or are there a few key things that, even if it's principles, that the regulatory community should focus on to adapt to this new digital and crypto ecosystem?
I sort of break it into two buckets. There's sort of the U.S., and then there's like the rest of the world. So I voted with my feet. I am working the rest of the world side of it. So at Bittrex, we split our businesses in two. We have a U.S.-only exchange for U.S. passport holders and U.S. residents, and then we have a non-U.S. part of the exchange, which has no U.S. passport holders and no U.S. residents. So that way, we've taken our non-U.S. clients and non-U.S. teams and projects and just taken them out of this whole U.S. sort of not black hole, but sort of amorphously gray area, as you've alluded to. So I think, you know, in Europe, you already have much clearer rules around what is a utility token, and it's a much more centralized financial services regulation to begin with in the EU. So that's why we have our utility token exchange in Liechtenstein. We are regulated under the Blockchain Act. They actually passed a law. So we want regulation, but we want clear, certain regulation from a centralized regulator. So I think the problem in the U.S., it's already just, you know, forget crypto. Financial services, as you just pointed out, has, you know, 50 state regulators. You've got the SEC, the, you know, OCC. Like, it's a mess to begin with. So even though the financial crypto is just each one of these assets, it's like square peg, square hole. Figure out what all these new assets, they just fit into the existing stuff. However, as we know, the regulators like to fight and have who's in charge. And so it's not going to be this linear path where we can just like allocate these new crypto assets into existing buckets. There's going to be a lot of fights, and that fighting creates uncertainty, not to mention a change of administration and everything else. So like they will get there, but the risk you run is that if you're in a new industry, you look at the situation Ripple is in the U.S. They issued some tokens a few years back. They think they're utility tokens. Outside of the U.S., they definitely are considered a utility token. But the SEC says, no, those are securities. So you illegally did a securities offering. And obviously, they're in a mess and, you know, fighting that in court. So you'll see a lot more of that type of stuff. And as I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, in, you know, financial services, it's a much sort of stricter penalty than if you make that mistake building a book selling company like Amazon and you just accidentally didn't charge sales tax. Like, that's a slap in the wrist, as opposed to, you know, breaches in financial services laws are very serious.
The bottom line is these regulators, as well as the lawmakers, sort of have their work cut out for them to either create an overarching regulatory framework or work within the one that exists to try to adapt it and stay one step ahead, or at least catch up with some of these developments. Because as you say, the crypto world is moving very, very quickly.
It's moving so fast. And then again, the rest of the world, other countries will pass legislation and they're much more nimble. And then the industry, look, the U.S. will always be there. It's a huge market. People will want to be here. But I think that this business is so international and you can run it in a different way because of the technology. You can have, you know, your company can be, I don't know, pick it. You can set it up in the Cayman Islands. They now pass crypto legislation. Our companies in Liechtenstein and also in Bermuda, where it's highly regulated and we have real regulators, but then the technology can be run in another country. Everything's on the cloud. And then your clients are global and they're using their cell phone to access it. So that didn't exist as a way of doing business. So 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago when they came out with most of these regulations. So it didn't anticipate this type of a setup. And it's unclear who's the regulator when you're running a global business like this. Is it where the client is? What, is it where the staff is? Is it where the entity is? So you have whole new paradigms that I just think, you know, the business is going to move so fast. So again, we've opted out for our non-US clients. We just have clarity elsewhere. We just don't have to worry about the US side of it because we're complying with regulations outside and we worry about the US regulations just for our US clients. I think it's more complicated for some of the US based businesses like Coinbase when they're writing a global book and they have to worry about the, you know, the US regulations extraterritorially. And I think it's harder to do the more innovative and esoteric things with complete uncertainty or the risk that they're going to come after you because you violated something you don't even know what you've done just because it's a gray area.
Right. So that's another very, very important point. It's not just about getting sort of the regulatory framework working domestically in a way that's sort of is, you know, both, as I said, provides sufficient regulatory oversight, but also allows innovation and is consistent across the U.S. It's also how do you do it globally? And so obviously, since the world is global, these currencies will want to be used, these crypto assets will want to be used globally cross-border. That's a whole nother angle to ensure there's some sort of international standards and global coordination. I do want to touch very briefly while we're on regulators and governments is central bank digital currencies. We talked about COVID and that it highlighted the inefficiency in the payment system and getting some of these relief payments out. It also highlighted concerns about the reemergence of inflation with a lot of this fiscal money coming into the system. But the other thing it highlighted as a result of this sort of focus and activity around Bitcoin and cryptos, it also highlighted the whole central bank digital currency area. And even though many governments have been exploring this, some have already launched pilots. We certainly have seen in Sweden and in China, and many are going on in Canada, ECB, Japan are looking at them. Singapore, Thailand are all, you know, have projects underway. But it really sort of, for a lot of them, was a wake-up call. We really need to be expediting our own examination or exploration of central bank digital currencies. So I guess I have two questions. And indeed, even in the U.S., we heard last week Chairman Powell say that, you know, exploring a digital dollar is a high priority. So and Secretary Yellen came in and said, yes, there could be some merits in some of these central bank digital
currencies.
There could
be some merit. That's called absolutely, we should have been doing it 10 years ago, but we never did. Well, and I have to basically deflect the issue away as a true politician.
Yeah, well, don't quote me on that. I don't know what her exact words were.
But I'm just joking. I mean, I'm sure it was something.
And we do indeed, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston is working on a very innovative project with MIT to sort of explore the technology behind it. But I guess one of the questions I have is, and of course they've said, but it won't be anytime soon, but let's see how this happens as the train is sort of out of the station. But what's your view on how you see central bank digital currencies existing and functioning alongside cryptocurrencies? Will they exist side by side? Does one have more of an advantage over another? I mean, obviously the whole idea of private cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin was to get away from centralized governments and government oversight. CBDC is kind of, you know, it's the central bank stepping right in there. So can you just comment from your perspective how you see these two assets?
So at a high level, so Bitcoin is a form of, let's say, a currency, but a central bank doesn't control the supply. It's a fixed supply. So Bitcoin, think of it as gold. It's a store of value in an inflationary environment. And that's why people like Bitcoin right now. And the price is going through the roof. as an alternative to holding dollars or any type of currency. But ironically, most of the trades in Bitcoin, I mean, it has to come back into fiat, into currency at some point, or there wouldn't be any value. So remember, Bitcoin's price is quoted in dollars or euros, but mainly in dollar. And the biggest market for Bitcoin is into dollars. But in the absence of a digital dollar, which again, a dollar is still a dollar, it's just a different format. So instead of having this piece of paper that's printed or a ledger entry at your bank, which is a dollar, you would have this dollar existing on the blockchain. So it would still be controlled by the Fed, the supply. Nothing's going to change. It's just a new way of settling a dollar. So it's a no-brainer. It has to happen. And blockchain, we talked about the inefficient bank settlement systems and ACH and stuff, but like, so a digital dollar would settle on the blockchain, and the blockchain, you can fully trace it. It's 24/7. The technology is much more better, and you wouldn't lose these payments because you could track every single payment and who it was made to, and then who they've then on-spent it to. So let's not go too much into the technology, but what's happening now? So in the absence of a central bank sponsored dollar, there are private issuers who've created that for them. And so one of the bigger tokens right now is called Tether, or USDT is the ticker. And so what is Tether? It's about $25 billion, and most of the Bitcoin transactions are going through Tether. And that's a private company. It's an exchange called Bitfinex, which has set up a token issuer. Each token is purported to be backed by a dollar. So every time they issue a token, they go out and buy a dollar, put it in a bank. And the bank in this case is a Bahamian bank called Deltek. And, you know, there was a famous lawsuit with New York, which just got settled. You can read about, you know, they questioned the efficacy of that arrangement. But putting that aside, in theory, it's just an unsponsored bank that's effectively, or a token issuer that's created this digital dollar. So obviously, if the Fed had one, I think people would prefer that. But there is none. So it shows you the demand already exists, and it's one of the number one tokens that exists right now. These are called stable coins because they are pegged to the value of a dollar. It's the same thing as of the Tesla stock. It's just a synthetic dollar. So it already exists. The market will create this. It's not going to wait for the regulator or the central bank to do it, and which is why the central banks just need to get in on the action. Because, you know, it creates all sorts of issues when you have a private issuer using your currency. And, you know, I think that if I were the Fed, I would want to have that myself.
So that's great. I mean, it really is a good explanation. And the comment on, you know, stable coins and noting their popularity and what they are actually does suggest this demand does indeed exist. I guess before we end, I just want to say, and maybe this goes back to the beginning, you know, what excites you the most about what you're seeing in digital and technology and crypto? And if you had a crystal ball, how do you think the future of money would look sort of 5 to 10 years out? Although I know that's like, you know, 50 years from 20 years ago. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love fast moving, disruptive things. And I think this is so disruptive and fast moving. So that's just exciting by definition. And it's always fun to see the sort of legacy banks. And don't forget, even though these banks like Goldman or JP Morgan, they're all entering crypto, you still can't get a bank account. If you're a company operating in crypto, it's like being in if marijuana, like they won't touch you. Like you can't get a bank account, you can't do anything. So it's still not so efficient, shall we say. So I'd say, you know, it's just fun to watch all these stodgy institutions that have so poo-pooed the technology. It's about to disrupt them and move past them at lightning speed. You know, and they had plenty of time where they just chose to not be in it. So that's always sort of fun. Like the disruptor in me likes that. And then I think in terms of the excitement about it, you know, you're taking financial services and making it truly global. And a lot of the, you know, the truly unbanked and, you know, I think a lot of these countries that had the same thing, you know, where they had no phone access and then cell phones, they immediately had phones. They didn't need to build landlines. Well, I think you have the same thing here for banking and financial services. Effectively, you know, crypto is a much more efficient system, and it will allow access globally for retail and just disintermediate these banks. But when you think about the opportunities for creating liquidity and new asset classes and diversification, both from an issuer standpoint and an investor standpoint, it's really exciting. I mean, again, like you said, you mentioned Christie's. So art, which is a highly illiquid asset and very expensive, all of a sudden you can tokenize art, and then you can break it into little pieces, and then you can own a token that represents a piece of a painting. You know the painting exists and where it's custodied, it's all on the blockchain. You can just turn everything upside down on its head, the way we finance things. So I find it creates efficiency, diversification, and, you know, it's good for humanity. It's good for the planet. So I think one should be very excited about this.
Well, thank you for that, Stephen. And just one point on your comments. We didn't spend much time talking about financial inclusion. I think, you know, folks like us take it for granted that that is definitely a big benefit, that it's very important to try to figure out ways to reach the unbanked. They represent a huge percentage of the world's population, at least in terms of what they should represent. Even I heard a number in the U.S., it's 25% of the population is either unbanked or underbanked. So the ability to reach the underbanked or the elderly who is used to using cash, I mean, all of these things are very, very important benefits aside from just, you know, opportunities to innovate and increase efficiency in the financial services. Stephen, thank you so much. We really appreciate you joining us today for sharing your insights on what really indeed are very fascinating and exciting developments in the crypto and digital world. And it's great to hear your views on sort of the future of money and, you know, what the traditional world of finance is facing and might look like. So thank you very much. We've learned a lot from you. Appreciate you being so candid and participating in our podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.